So here's a common blessing before Torah study. Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu melech haolam asher kidshanu b'mitzvotav v'tzivanu la'asok b'dvarei Torah. Blessed are you, Lord our God, King of the universe, who sanctifies us with his commands and commands us to be engaged with the words of Torah. I like that prayer. Well, this week's parsha is Parshat Tzav. Can you say Tzav? Tzav. It focuses on a number of different sacrifices, including one that is called Ha'olah. Ha'olah, say that. And Ha'olah is a burnt offering. And it is one which the Jewish sages said was specifically for sinful thoughts. And this weekend, as I mentioned earlier, Shabbat HaGadol, the great Shabbat, which comes before Passover, there are some questions about the origin of the celebration of Shabbat HaGadol. And I was reading in Jewish Encyclopedia about this, and it said that it may have been from the early Messianic Jews, that on the 10th of Nisan, 4 days before the 14th of Nisan, which was the night of Passover, on the 10th of Nisan, the Jewish people would bring their lamb. That's what they were instructed to do in Egypt. Bring a lamb out of your flock and take it to your house. It has to be a male, perfect, without spot or blemish. Watch over it very carefully during those 4 days to make sure that it is perfect. And then on the 14th day, sacrifice it. And at twilight, they were to sacrifice it. They were to take the blood and apply it to the doorposts of their house, the front doors. And then they were to roast it and eat it and remain inside. And this blood would be a sign to God as he went through the land of Egypt. It would be a sign for him to come and to stand between the houses of the children of Israel and the angel of death, who was coming in order to bring judgment through the slaying of the firstborn sons. So there's some debate, some uncertainty about the origin of this and even the nature of the celebration of Shabbat HaGadol originally. Now it's basically celebrated in the modern Jewish world on that Shabbat that comes before Passover. But there's some reason to believe that it was celebrated occasionally, because it would only be celebrated when on that Shabbat it was also the 10th of Nisan. And not every Shabbat is the 10th of Nisan, you know, that comes before Passover, because there could be any one of 7 different days, you know, in counting before that. So in the debate, there's some different opinions, but there's also some reason to believe that the practice of Good Friday emerged out of that. Isn't that interesting? That the Messianic Jews took special note of this holiday and when it occurred. Now, of course, modern Good Friday and ancient Shabbat HaGadol, you know, they probably don't look very much like each other anymore. But that's neither here nor there. I'm mainly bringing this up because it's interesting when we discover Messianic Jewish precedents that are hidden from public view, if you will. And it's good to uncover them and to show how they were the precedent that somehow was relied upon and found its way into Christian practice. Well, I want to read to you from Leviticus chapter 6, verses 8 and 9, which is the beginning of this parsha. It says, "Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, Command Aaron and his sons, saying, This is the law of the burnt offering, or the law, the Torah of Ha'olah. The burnt offering shall be on the hearth upon the altar all night until morning, and the fire of the altar shall be kept burning on it." And so this was a specific offering that was brought through fire. You brought the offering, you put it on the fire, and the fire burned all night long. The question was, what was this offering for specifically? And the Jewish sages were in agreement as to the purpose of this offering. They said that this offering was for sins in your thought life and sins of the heart. And I think this is very important for us to pay attention to, because in much of the modern Jewish world, it is not considered a sin to have bad thoughts or to have bad things going in our hearts. In fact, there are some parts of the Jewish world, modern Jewish world, which say only action can be sin. So contemplation of something is not sin. Until you've acted, it can't really be sin. But the Jewish sages don't really agree with this. So this is an example where modern Judaism often is ignorant of its own teachings, the teachings of Judaism. I want to bring these forward to you because the sages and Messianic Judaism are in agreement with how to perceive these things. And so it's useful for us to pay attention to such an unusual detail as the burnt offering. In Vayikra Rabbah, Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai said that this offering was for the sins of the contemplation of the heart and for forbidden thoughts. And he had a list of some of the forbidden thoughts. That's right. And I'll give you some examples. These are thoughts we're not supposed to entertain. Fear of the sword. It's a motorcycle. Oh, I thought it was something else. That's good. Fear of tyranny. Idle thoughts. Thoughts of the evil inclination. Thoughts of sexual licentiousness. Thoughts of evil women. Thoughts of idolatry. Here's one that's really interesting. The fear of being controlled by other people and obsessive thoughts. All of these are considered to be forbidden thoughts that require atonement. In the Jerusalem Talmud in Yoma, it says the thoughts of the heart are atoned for with the burnt offering. And it also goes on to say that the thought of a sin can be worse than the sin itself. The thought of a sin can be worse than the sin itself. And it goes on to explain that there are certain sins which people decide they're never going to act on. They're not going to do. But nevertheless, within themselves, they entertain the sin. They think about it. They mull it over. I'll give some examples. For instance, have you ever said to yourself, I could kill that person? You wouldn't do it, but you think about it, right? Maybe up to the point, you know, like, well, I would grab them by the throat, or I would hit them on the head with the right object, or I would push them into traffic. You know, you have those kinds of thoughts. There's a particular kind of thought that's very common among believers in Messiah, and that is bitterness, the thought of bitterness, the attitude of bitterness. And people who know we are to forgive nevertheless mull over unforgiveness in our hearts. And maybe we're careful not to say the wrong thing in someone else's hearing. And yet inside, in that quiet place where you can think and no one hears your thoughts, or when you can feel and no one is listening, inside you can mull over unforgiveness. You can find yourself even being subject to it late at night. Have you ever had torments late at night when you're trying to go to sleep and then thoughts of something troubling come to you? How many have had that kind of experience? You know what I'm talking about. Or you finally get to sleep and then you wake up in the morning and bam, a thought pops into your mind. And you have to deal with it. And there may be these moments when it's a struggle. And that's why this statement, the thought of a sin can be worse than the sin itself. You've already decided not to act on the sin. and yet you can be ruled over it because of the power that it has within your own heart or in your own mind. Rabbi Ari Kahn says, the olah, the burnt offering, was an offering that was brought, which brought about forgiveness for thoughts. And he said, just as a person's passions burn at night, the sacrificial animal, which represents the physical side of the person, burns all night until only spirit is left. Yeshua takes up this theme of sinful thoughts. He talks about it often in the Gospels that's recorded for us. I'll bring out just one example. It's in Matthew chapter 5, verses 27 and 28. Yeshua said, you've heard that it was said, you shall not commit adultery. So how many of you have heard that said? You shall not commit adultery. Yeshua said, but I say to you that everyone who looks at a woman with lust for her has already committed adultery with her in his heart. So you've got the action of physical adultery, and then you've got the thought of adultery. They're connected. They're connected. They're not exactly identical. I'll show you this. If your spouse comes to you and says, I need you to forgive me, I committed adultery, you would much prefer that it was in the area of their thoughts than that it had been physically consummated. Isn't that true? Isn't that true? Yeah, it is. Nevertheless, they're connected. In other words, the things that are being stirred up inside of us, the things in our heart, the things in our minds, are connected to our actions. Actions rarely arise out of nowhere. They generally arise out of the contemplations of the heart and out of the intents of the mind. Now, the Messianic Jewish apostle Yaakov, mistranslated into English as James, speaks about this in chapter 1, verse 14 and 15. He says, each one is tempted when he's carried away and enticed by the lusts and the desires in his own heart and mind. And then when lust and desire have conceived, they give birth to sin. And when sin is accomplished with action, it brings forth death. So Yaakov is making this connection between the internal things of the heart and of the mind and the way that they work, the sequences that they work in. And he even says it this way, which is quite profound, that when you're mulling things over in your heart, when you're contemplating them in your mind, then that's when you can be tempted. Because you're already considering, thinking about, struggling with. Now, to be tempted is not a sin. But he's talking about that specific condition when you get tempted because you're already sinning in the area of the thought or the mind, or you're trying to resist it. Have you ever tried to resist bitterness or unforgiveness? And you've had a relationship with someone who really did wrong to you. And you felt like you had victory. You know, there was a time before God where you said, Lord, I forgive them. And maybe you forgave them 100 times. Am I the only one in the room who's forgiven someone 100 times? Or maybe you've even forgiven 70 times 7. Am I the only one here who has had to do that? I don't think so. And so have you had that experience of having forgiven someone and then you see them again and they do it again? And it's as if you have to start all the way back and work your way through it. This, I think, is not unfamiliar to many of us. And so there is this reality where the things of the heart, the things of the mind are so important that we need to deal with them and we need forgiveness. So it's important for us to understand the Bible is speaking about the remedy for that, the remedy for sinful thoughts. And in saying there's a remedy, it's saying there's a problem. There's a problem in the area of our thoughts and in the area of our minds. And what's the remedy? Well, one of the common Jewish teachings is study Torah. Let the Torah of God come into your heart and come into your mind. The New Covenant take on that is very similar. It's this, that in the New Covenant, the Torah is actually engraved on your heart and engraved on your mind. And because of that, no one has to say to you, know the Lord. Because all will know the Lord from the least to the greatest. And in the New Covenant, our sins will be forgiven and our iniquities will be remembered no more. So there's something contained in the New Covenant just for that purpose. But Paul writes to the Ephesians about what it takes to bring a remedy. And I really like what he says. For some people, it will just seem way too impractical. Some people will say, well, give me the steps for this one. I'm not going to give you any more than Paul gave us today. But it's in Ephesians chapter 4, verse 23 and 24. This is one of the remedies that he says. Be renewed in the spirit of your mind. That's a remedy. That's a New Covenant remedy. Be renewed in the spirit of your mind. Let's just pay attention to that. What does renew mean? It means to be made new. Now, what on earth does that mean? That means whatever is old that's got you down needs to be renewed so that it's different. It's not just that you would cope with such things, it's that you would become renewed. You would become renewed in the spirit of your mind. That phrase, spirit of your mind, is not used throughout the scriptures. So we really have to try to develop our own understanding of what it means. I think it means this. It's the intersection of the things of the spirit and the things of the mind. And you allow the things of the spirit, your spiritual man, your spiritual woman, to take authority over the things of the mind, the areas of your thought. It's similar to what the psalmist went through when he said, bless the Lord, O my soul, and all that is within me, bless his holy name. Who was going to do the blessings, or what part was going to do the blessings? Of the psalmist, the soul, right? So who's doing the talking? It's that part of the person that has authority over his own soul. Now, when do you have authority over your own soul? It's when you are very submitted to God regarding your whole being. That part of you that draws close to God, that part of you that draws strength from Him, that part that has intimacy with Him, receives things from God. And when you're receiving things from God, you can take authority over every aspect of your person, including your thoughts. Have you ever had a thought pop into your mind and you knew it wasn't good? And you were ashamed of it even. But you took authority over it. You took a position, I am not going to think that thought. The fact that you had the thought doesn't mean that you agree with the thought. You exercise authority. So you get renewed. You renew yourself in the spirit of your mind. I think that's the first part that what he's talking about. And then verse 24 is the second part. And put on the new self, which in the likeness of God has been created in righteousness and holiness of the truth. Now, I want to take apart some bad theology that people have. Have you ever heard someone say, I need to die to myself? And there's an element of truth for that, but there's also a confusion. Paul isn't saying here, die to yourself. He has said elsewhere, and the scriptures say elsewhere, die to sin. Say that phrase, die to sin. Die to sin means I am no longer going to be under the authority of sin. I'm not going to be a hapless victim of the power of sin. Now, I'm going to be dead regarding its authority over me. Now, if I'm dead, then what's left of me? The new man. who's made new in Messiah. That one has to rise up. Paul says it this way, put on that new person. We don't have time to go into the important issues around the new self and the old self, but I want to tell you this. You don't want the new self to die. It's the old self you want to put down. So you put down the old, you put on the new. You embrace the new. And that new self is that part of you, that aspect of your being that's connected with God's heart, with God's purpose, with God's word, and you allow that to roll. Now, sometimes people simply have problems because they are trying to live with the old self being managed, being controlled. You try to put a bit and a bridle in the old self. It's like, man, that old self is at work. The problem isn't the old self. The problem is that you're letting the old self rule over you rather than putting on the new self. And there are times when we need to make an exchange. We need to say, I can't control that person, but he doesn't have authority over me. I've been made new. And I can't tell you all the ins and outs of it, but it starts with a position. It starts with taking a position and saying, God, in you, I'm new. In you, I'm new. In you, I am new. You make all things new again. Now, the moment you start taking that position, it's not just a matter of words. It means that which is true about what is new starts relating to God in an authoritative way in your life and starts telling you the way things are going to be rather than the old man telling you the way things have been or were or will be if you keep allowing him to. There's a proverb that talks about a man being like a wild horse that can be controlled with a bit and a bridle. But the Lord is not wanting us to be like a wild horse that can be controlled with a bit and a bridle. He wants us to be like a trained horse that can be controlled with a word, with a glance, with a slight nudge, and will move in the right direction and do the right thing with the least instruction. Be renewed in the spirit of your mind. Put on the new self. These things are so important to us. Now, if we're going to embrace these kinds of things, it's very important that we not become deadly serious. There are times when seriousness will defeat you. When the harder you try to be right, the more difficult it is. And there is a place for laughing at sin. It is not in order to mock its power. It's not in order to deny what's really going on. It's a position of saying, I'm not under that authority of the power of sin. I'm not under it. Now, you might say, in my behavior, it appears that I am. You might say that to yourself. But there's a way into something else. This is part of the mystery of the new covenant, which makes it even better than the first covenant. It is a powerful difference to be able to say, I'm not under the power of sin and death at a moment when it appears that you are. Now imagine if you were a fish and there was a hook in your mouth and you're saying, I am not under the power of fishing lines. That really won't help, will it? That's just denial. When the fish sees that bait on the hook and it says, I'm not under the power. And it goes another way. That's when it's not under the power. You see? when faced with a situation, you put on the new self. You renew yourself. Once you're caught, you're caught. You got to get uncaught to get out of this mess. Are you with me? This is a Pesach message. Because at Passover, the key to Israel getting free is to get out. This is not Purim message, where the key to getting free is to stand your place and seek the Lord and stay there. So there are times, and this is such a time for us, where we need Pesach, not Purim. We need to get out of the land of bondage and go into the land of freedom. Now, a key to freedom is the desire for freedom. Because anyone who desires to stay in bondage will stay in bondage and will run back if they're liberated. They will return. One of the Proverbs compares that to a dog that vomits and then goes back and eats it. Isn't that disgusting? It's a boy proverb. Not for girls. But maybe you've seen this happen. And you say, what on earth is that all about? It's as if that behavior, which is acceptable to a dog, is repeated in humans and is unacceptable. It's when we return to the bondage that we had just gotten out of. There was a temptation on Israel to go back into bondage in order to get out of fear. Afraid of being free, they were tempted to go back. But this is Shabbat HaGadol, and so it's a time to remember the lamb that was taken into each household. And when the apostles described Yeshua's sacrifice as a Passover sacrifice, as a Pesach, as a Kippur, an atoning sacrifice, it meant something to them. When they spoke, for instance, when Paul said to the Corinthians, Messiah our Pesach, he wasn't talking about something without history. He was talking about the Passover lamb that had been slain, that had been taken to each house. Each one had to take a lamb. It wasn't enough that your neighbor took one or your dad took one. You had to have one for your house too. And you had to eat of it. And you had to be in such a house that had the blood of the lamb on the doorposts of your house. So it's important for us to remind ourselves of that in order to really grasp what it means when we're saying that Yeshua is our Pesach. It's not just a shallow metaphor. It's something very, very deep. When we're saying Yeshua is our Pesach, we're saying He is the one who stood between us and death. He was the one who liberated us from bondage and from slavery. He was the one, His blood became the power that delivers us from judgment. What was the difference between the households of Israel and the households of Egypt? The blood of the Lamb that was put on those houses as a demonstration of faith. When we say Yeshua is the Pesach, we're saying His blood is recognized by the God of Israel. When the God of Israel is searching to see who belongs to Him, He looks for who has blood on His doors. When He's looking who belongs to Him today, He's looking for who has the blood of the Pesach Messiah. When we say Yeshua is the Pesach, we're saying He's the one we have to eat, because it wasn't just blood, you had to eat. No wonder Yeshua said, if you don't eat of Me, you have nothing to do with Me. How could anybody talk like that? Well, the Lord had already given all of the nation of Israel this experience of having to eat a lamb and having to take its blood. When we say Yeshua is the Pesach, we're saying He's the one by whom we demonstrate our faith in God. We are saying that I belong to Him. We put the blood on our doors. We take the blood of Messiah ourselves in so many different ways, and we're saying, I have separated myself from the faithless, and I am to be counted among the faithful. When God is going through the land of Egypt, he's looking for the faithful. What's he counting? The blood of the Lamb. That's it. Right? That's it. How can that be enough? It's because that was God's provision. That was what God promised. So no wonder Paul is saying to the Corinthians, if you understand how God worked in our midst in Egypt, you can understand the new covenant that's been extended to you. No wonder Paul made it a requirement of learning for the Gentiles that they would know the Passover. They would know the Exodus. They would know the purging of leaven from our houses. How else could they understand anything? Unless they built their understanding upon the real work and history of God with the Jewish people, they couldn't understand what was happening to them. They would misunderstand it. I can go on in that direction. You know me. I'm not. When we're saying Yeshua is the Pesach, we're saying he's the one by whom we're protected. He protected us. We couldn't protect ourselves. What is it about the blood of the Lamb that protects us? It's that God recognizes the blood of the Lamb and comes and stands as protection for us. We don't try to protect ourselves in such moments. But we are also, through him, declaring who we belong to. When we take the blood of the Lamb in Egypt and we apply it to the doorposts of our houses, we're saying, we belong to the God of Israel. That's very important. The Jewish sages say that the Egyptians worshipped lambs. And so when Israel was going to sacrifice lambs, it was abhorrent to the Egyptians that we would use a lamb and that our God would recognize it. It was a terrifying thing. It was also a way that we marked ourselves as the enemies of Egypt. In the same way, when we take the blood of the Lamb, we are saying, you want to bring that to me? We are saying that we belong to God. We are saying that we are his, this house belongs to God. And this blood of the Lamb, the blood of the Pesach, is a sign in the invisible world that we belong to God and not to the angel of death. There are moments in spiritual battle, and many of you are facing spiritual battles, whether you recognize it or not. You may not have even identified that the struggle you're in is a spiritual battle. You may have thought it was something else. But it's actually a spiritual battle with spiritual dimensions, and the victory will come in the spirit, not some other way. But there are times when your greatest protection is to simply proclaim your confidence in the blood of the Lamb. And there are moments when your spiritual enemy will want to come and destroy you. And you'll try to defend yourself in every way that you can, and nothing will work until you take refuge in the blood of the Lamb. And you offer up the blood of the Lamb. Just like in Egypt, this is what Paul is saying for the New Covenant believers. We take up Yeshua, the Pesach, and the blood of this Lamb. And we offer it up. It's like this. I have no protection. I have no defense. I have no way of saving myself from my enemy except the blood of the Lamb. And when you take refuge in the blood of the Lamb, victory starts coming to you of kinds that cannot come any other way. How can I talk like this? Because this is what happened to our people in Egypt. They took refuge in the blood of the Lamb. Because I know that historic reality, I can understand the spiritual reality of taking refuge in Yeshua. Without knowing what happened in Egypt, how could I be sure about Yeshua? But knowing one gives me confidence in the other. There are times when the enemy attacks and you're accustomed to trying to fight back using all of the normal tools that you have and nothing works. He says you're a loser and you say, I'm not a loser. He says you're never going to make it and you say, I am going to make it. You try to fight him back with his own words. You try to negate his own words and nothing works. And I'll tell you another way. Imagine in Egypt, Egyptians saying to the Jews, you're always going to be a slave. You're always going to be under our thumb. You're never going back to your land. You'll serve us. Now, you can argue all you want, but that's not what Israel did. What did Israel do? They took refuge in obedience. They took refuge in faithfulness. And they complied with God's specific directives that were promised and guaranteed to work. You're always going to be a slave. Blood of the Lamb. You're always going to be under our thumb. Blood of the Lamb. Okay, today, you're a loser. It goes like this. It's true. The blood of the Lamb makes me new. You're never going to change. It's true. Left to my own devices. The blood of the Lamb. Put on the new self. He will never change. Me, however, I will. I count him dead. We don't play together anymore. I like this. In modern America, among believers of every kind, but unfortunately, especially among evangelical Christians, the bad news sells better than the good news. Do you know what the word gospel means? It means good news. It's not a kind of music, but it can be applied to that. Gospel means good news. Just turn to someone and say, gospel means good news. So you and I need to take refuge in the good news of Messiah. The good news is he has victory over sin and death. The good news is it all works out. It all works out. As difficult as it is, it all works out. As hard as it really is, and with the ups and the downs, it all works out. It all works out. It all works out. Doesn't mean you get to keep all your stuff. If you think life working out means you get to have more and more stuff and never lose any of it, then you will think life doesn't work out. But God's promise is not just about your stuff. Because in the end, you know what? You don't get to take any of your stuff with you. In the end, you go back to the dust and up from the grave. And your stuff stays behind. You don't get to take it, and you won't need it. Whatever stuff you're going to need in the world to come will be provided for you from that time. So maybe you'll lose your stuff. So you have to decide, do you worship your stuff? Or can you let it go? At Pesach, we remember to let it go. There were Jews living in Egypt who had lived there for 400 years and had land that they lived on. And when it was time to go, they could have said, "Oh, I don't even have a mortgage on the property." Let it go. Let it go, because only slaves stay behind. Let it go. "But then I'll be broke." Yep, but you're starting over clean. And on the way out, ask for gold and silver. Right? And by then the Egyptians said, "Quickly go. We'll give you whatever you need, whatever you want. Take it, go. Just don't kill the rest of us." If you think about the kinds of communications that you see on TV these days, that you get emails about, that you read about, you'll see just how much of it is related to the bad news. In fact, there is a whole business enterprise of ministry that's based on the bad news. And it calls itself prophecy. But it's not. But its whole marketplace idea is, we will explain the bad news that's coming. Not only do they want to explain the bad news that's here, they want to explain the bad news that's coming. And there are people who are fascinated with their anticipation of bad news. Absorbed in it. What's next? Can you imagine? Thrilled to discover one more thing that's bad. And yet the gospel is good news. And you and I need to distinguish ourselves by not being absorbed with what is bad. And it's not that we ignore it, it's just we're not defeated by it. In this world you will have troubles. Take heart, Yeshua said, "I've overcome this world." So you will have troubles. Turn to the person next to you and just look at them straight in the eye and say, "You will have troubles. You will have troubles. You will have troubles. I guarantee it." On the basis of Yeshua's promise. I'm standing on the promise. I will have troubles. But they won't defeat me. And every trouble that comes my way does not take me from God. Because God knows how to distinguish between troubles. How to defeat the ones that would just utterly destroy me. How to protect me. How to deliver me, and then how to turn upside down troubles that were meant for harm and to turn them into good. He does spiritual judo on them. They come at you. They look like they're going to destroy you, and they're on the ground. That's nice. That's Pesach. What's your plan to get out of Egypt? Roast lamb? All the Jews are losers. No. That's how we won. Not by destroying our enemy, but by coming out from our enemy. And so in the new covenant, come out. Come out. Come out. Remember what we used to say as kids? You're playing hide and seek. Oli, oli, in, come free. Come out. It's safe. Come into the new covenant. Walk under the protection of God. You'll be glad you did. Let's close with this prayer. Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu melech ha'olam asher bachar banu mikol ha'amim v'natan lanu et torato. Baruch atah Adonai, Noten HaTorah. Blessed are you, Lord our God, King of the universe, who has chosen us from all peoples and given us your Torah. Blessed are you, O Lord, giver of the Torah. Would you stand up? I want you to hear one of my favorite prayers from Zechariah chapter 14, verse 9, one of the Hebrew prayers in the Siddur called Vene'emar. Vene'emar, Vahaya Adonai lamelech al kol ha'aretz, Bayom hahu yiyeh Adonai echad ushmo echad. It has been said, the Lord will be king over all the earth, and in that day the Lord will be one and his name one. Thank you, Lord, for that coming day. Let's close with Aaron's blessing. Gather together so no one's standing alone. Yivarechecha Adonai v'yishmarecha. Ye'er Adonai panav elecha v'ichunecha. Yisa Adonai panav elecha v'yasem lecha shalom. The Lord bless you and the Lord protect you through the blood of the Lamb. The Lord cause the light of his face to shine upon you. The Lord be gracious to you, giving his favor to you, giving you far more than you ever could deserve or merit. The Lord lift up his face to you and give you his shalom in the name of Yeshua, the Prince of Peace. Amen. Amen. Shabbat shalom. Join us for Oneg.